You is just one person. Sometimes I think he knew I was there. Maybe he kept saying it to give me time to get brave enough to pick up. Also, there was so much space between the times he asked. There are 15 seconds between the third and the fourth, which is the longest space. You can hear people in the background screaming and crying. And you can hear glass breaking, which is part of what makes me wonder if people were jumping. Are you there? 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 Are you? And then it cut off. I've timed the message, and it's 1 minute and 27 seconds, which means it ended at 10:24, which was when the building came down. So maybe that's how he died. I'm so sorry, he said. I've never told that to anyone. He squeezed me, almost like a hug, and I could feel him shaking his head. I asked him, "Do you forgive me?"
"Do I forgive you?"
"Yeah."
"For not being able to pick up?"
"For not being able to tell anyone."
He said, "I do."
I took the string off my neck and put it around his neck.
"What about this other key?" he asked.
I told him, "That's to our apartment." The renter was standing under the street lamp when I got home. We met there every night to talk about the details of our plan, like what time we should leave and what we'd do if it was raining or if a guard asked us what we were doing. We ran out of realistic details in just a few meetings, but for some reason we still weren't ready to go. So we made up unrealistic details to plan, like alternate driving routes in case the 59th Street Bridge collapsed, and ways to get over the cemetery fence in case it was electrified, and how to outsmart the police if we were arrested. We had all sorts of maps and secret codes and tools. We probably would have gone on making plans forever if I hadn't met William Black that night and learned what I'd learned. The renter wrote, "You're late." I shrugged my shoulders, just like Dad used to. He wrote, "I got us a rope ladder, just in case." I nodded.
"Where were you? I was worried."
I told him, "I found the lock."
"You found it?"
I nodded.
"And?"
I didn't know what to say. I found it, and now I can stop looking. I found it, and it had nothing to do with Dad. I found it. And now I'll wear heavy boots for the rest of my life. I wish I hadn't found it.
It wasn't what you were looking for?
That's not it.
Then what?
I found it, and now I can't look for it. I could tell he didn't understand me. Looking for it let me stay close to him for a little while longer.
But won't you always be close to him?
I knew the truth. No. He nodded like he was thinking of something, or thinking about a lot of things, or thinking about everything, if that's even possible. He wrote, "Maybe it's time to do the thing we've been planning." I opened my left hand, because I knew if I tried to say something, I'd just start crying. We agreed to go on Thursday night, which was the second anniversary of Dad's death, which seemed appropriate. Before I walked into the building, he handed me a letter. "What's this?" He wrote, "Stan went to get coffee. He told me to give this to you in case he didn't get back in time." "What is it?" He shrugged his shoulders and went across the street. "Dear Oscar Schell, I've read every letter that you've sent me these past 2 years. In return, I've sent you many form letters with the hope of one day being able to give you the proper response you deserve. But the more letters you wrote to me and the more of yourself you gave, the more daunting my task became. I'm sitting beneath a pear tree as I dictate this to you, overlooking the orchards of a friend's estate. I spent the past few days here, recovering from some medical treatment that has left me physically and emotionally depleted. As I moped about this morning, feeling sorry for myself, it occurred to me, like a simple solution to an impossible problem. Today is the day I've been waiting for. You asked me in your first letter if you could be my protege. I don't know about that, but I would be happy to have you join me in Cambridge for a few days. I could introduce you to my colleagues, treat you to the best curry outside India, and show you just how boring the life of an astrophysicist can be. If you so choose, Oscar, you can have a bright future in the sciences. I would be happy to do anything possible to facilitate such a path. It's wonderful to think about what would happen if you put your imagination towards scientific ends. But, Oscar, intelligent people write to me all the time. In your fifth letter, you asked, what if I never stop inventing? That question has stuck with me. I wish I were a poet. I've never confessed that to anyone, and I'm confessing it to you because you've given me reason to feel that I can trust you. I've spent my life observing the universe, mostly in my mind's eye. It's been a tremendously rewarding life, a wonderful life. I've been able to explore the origins of time and space with some of the great living thinkers. But I wish I were a poet. Albert Einstein, a hero of mine, once wrote, "Our situation is the following. We are standing in front of a closed box, which we cannot open." I'm sure I don't have to tell you that the vast majority of the universe is composed of dark matter. The fragile balance depends on things we'll never be able to see, hear, smell, taste, or touch. Life itself depends on them. What's real? What isn't real? Maybe those aren't the right questions to be asking. What does life depend on? I wish I had made things for life to depend on. What if you never stop inventing? Maybe you're not inventing at all. I'm being called in for breakfast, and so I'll have to end this letter here. There's more I want to tell you, and more I want to hear from you. It's a shame we live on different continents. One shame of many. It's so beautiful at this hour. The sun is low, the shadows are long, the air is cold and clean. You won't be awake for another 5 hours, but I can't help feeling that we're sharing this clear and beautiful morning. Your friend, Stephen Hawking.
My feelings. A knocking woke me up in the middle of the night. I had been dreaming about where I came from. I put on my robe and went to the door. Who could it be? Why didn't the doorman ring up? A neighbor? But why? More knocking. I looked through the peephole. It was your grandfather. Come in. Where were you? Are you okay? The bottoms of his pants were covered in dirt. Are you okay? he nodded. Come in, let me clean you off. What happened? He shrugged his shoulders. Did someone hurt you? He showed me his right hand. Are you hurt? We went to the kitchen table and sat down. Next to each other. The windows were black. He put his hands on his knees. I slid closer to him until our sides touched. I put my head on his shoulder. I wanted as much of us to touch as possible. I told him, "You have to tell me what happened for me to be able to help." He took a pen from his shirt pocket, but there was nothing to write on. I gave him my open hand. He wrote, "I want to get you some magazines." In my dream, all of the collapsed ceilings reformed above us. The fire went back into the bombs, which rose up and into the bellies of the planes whose propellers turned backwards, like the second hands of the clocks across Dresden, only faster. I wanted to slap him with his words. I wanted to shout, "It isn't fair!" and bang my fists against the table like a child. "Anything special?" he asked on my arm. "Everything special," I said. "Art magazines? Yes. Nature magazines? Yes. Politics? Yes. Celebrities? Yes." I told him to bring a suitcase so he could come back with one of everything. I wanted him to be able to take his things with him. In my dream, spring came after summer, came after fall, came after winter, came after spring. I made him breakfast. I tried to make it delicious. I wanted him to have good memories, so that maybe he would come back again one day, or at least miss me. I wiped the rim of the plate before I gave it to him. I spread his napkin on his lap. He didn't say anything. When the time came, I went downstairs with him. There was nothing to write on, so he wrote on me. "I might not be back until late." I told him I understood. He wrote, "I'm going to get you magazines." I told him, "I don't want any magazines." "Maybe not now, but you'll be grateful to have them. My eyes are crummy." "Your eyes are perfect. Promise me that you'll take care." He wrote, "I'm only going to get magazines." "Don't cry," I said, by putting my fingers on my face and pushing imaginary tears up my cheeks and back into my eyes. I was angry because they were my tears. I told him, "You're only getting magazines." He showed me his left hand. I tried to notice everything because I wanted to be able to remember it perfectly. I've forgotten everything important in my life. I can't remember what the front door of the house I grew up in looked like, or who stopped kissing first, me or my sister, or the view from any window but my own. Some nights I lay awake for hours trying to remember my mother's face. He turned around and walked away from me. I went back up to the apartment and sat on the sofa waiting. Waiting for what? I can't remember the last thing my father said to me. He was trapped under the ceiling. The plaster that covered him was red with his blood. He said, "I can't feel everything." I didn't know if he'd meant to say he couldn't feel anything. He asked, "Where is Mommy?" I didn't know if he was talking about my mother or his. I tried to pull the ceiling off him. He said, "Can you find my glasses for me?" I told him I would look for them. But everything had been buried. I had never seen my father cry before. He said, with my glasses I could be helpful. I told him, let me try to free you. He said, find my glasses. They were shouting for everyone to get out. The rest of the ceiling was about to collapse. I wanted to stay with him, but I knew he would want me to leave him. I told him, Daddy, I have to leave you. Then he said something. It was the last thing he ever said to me. I can't remember it. In my dream, the tears went up his cheeks and back into his eyes. I got up off the sofa and filled a suitcase with the typewriter and as much paper as would fit. I wrote a note and taped it to the window. I didn't know whom it was for. I went from room to room, turning off the lights. I made sure none of the faucets were dripping. I turned off the heat and unplugged the appliances. I closed all the windows. As the cab drove me away, I saw the note. But I couldn't read it because my eyes are crummy. In my dream, painters separated green into yellow and blue, brown into the rainbow. Children pulled color from coloring books with crayons, and mothers who had lost children mended their black clothing with scissors. I think about all of the things I've done, Oscar, and all of the things I didn't do. The mistakes I've made are dead to me. But I can't take back the things I never did. I found him in the international terminal. He was sitting at a table with his hands on his knees. I watched him all morning. He asked people what time it was, and each person pointed at the clock on the wall. I have been an expert at watching him. It's been my life's work. From my bedroom window, from behind trees, from across the kitchen table. I wanted to be with him, or anyone. I don't know if I've ever loved your grandfather, but I've loved not being alone. I got very close to him. I wanted to shout myself into his ear. I touched his shoulder. He lowered his head. How could you? He wouldn't show me his eyes. I hate silence. Say something! He took his pen from his shirt pocket and the top napkin from the stack on the table. He wrote, "You were happy when I was away." How could you think that? We are lying to ourselves and to each other. Lying about what? I don't care if we're lying. I am a bad person. I don't care. I don't care what you are. I can't. What's killing you? He wrote, "You're killing me." And then I was silent. He wrote, "You remind me." I put my hands on the table and told him, "You have me." He took another napkin and wrote, "Anna was pregnant." I told him, "I know. She told me." "You know?" "I didn't think you knew. She said it was a secret. I'm glad you know." He wrote, "I'm sorry I know. It's better to lose than never to have had. I lost something I never had." "You had everything." "When did she tell you?" "We were in bed talking." He pointed at when. "Near the end." "What did she say?" She said, I'm going to have a baby. Was she happy? She was overjoyed. Why didn't you say anything? Why didn't you? In my dream, people apologized for things that were about to happen, and lit candles by inhaling. I have been seeing Oscar, he wrote. I know. You know? Of course I know. He flipped back to, why didn't you say anything? Why didn't you? The alphabet went Z, Y, X, W. The clocks went tock, tick, tock, tick. He wrote, I was with him last night. That's where I was. I buried the letters. What letters? The letters I never sent. Buried them where? In the ground. That's where I was. I buried the key, too. What key? To your apartment. Our apartment. He put his hands on the table. Lovers pulled up each other's underwear, buttoned each other's shirts, and dressed and dressed and dressed. I told him, say it. When I saw Anna for the last time, say it. When we... say it! He put his hands on his knees. I wanted to hit him. I wanted to hold him. I wanted to shove myself into his ear. I asked, so what happens now? I don't know. Do you want to go home? He flipped back to, I can't. Then you'll go away? He pointed at, I can't. Then we are out of options. We sat there. Things were happening around us, but nothing was happening between us. Above us, the screen said which flights were landing and which were taking off. Madrid departing, Rio arriving, Stockholm departing, Paris departing, Milan arriving. Everyone was coming or going. People around the world were moving from one place to another. No one was staying. I said, what if we stay? Stay? Here. What if we stay here at the airport? He wrote, is that another joke? I shook my head, no. How could we stay here? I told him there are payphones, so I could call Oscar and let him know I'm okay. And there are paper stores where you could buy day books and pens. There are places to eat. And money machines. And bathrooms. Even televisions. Not coming or going. Not something or nothing. Not yes or no. My dream went all the way back to the beginning. The rain rose into the clouds, and the animals descended the ramp. Two by two, two giraffes, two spiders, two goats, two lions, two mice, two monkeys, two snakes, two elephants. The rain came after the rainbow. As I type this, we are sitting across from each other at a table. It's not big, but it's big enough for the two of us. He has a cup of coffee and I am drinking tea. When the pages are in the typewriter, I can't see his face. In that way, I am choosing you over him. I don't need to see him. I don't need to know if he is looking up at me. It's not even that I trust him not to leave. I know this won't last. I'd rather be me than him. The words are coming so easily. The pages are coming easily. At the end of my dream, Eve put the apple back on the branch. The tree went back into the ground. It became a sapling, which became a seed. God brought together the land and the water, the sky and the water, evening and morning, something and nothing. He said, "Let there be light." And there was darkness. Oscar, the night before I lost everything was like any other night. Anna and I kept each other awake very late. We laughed, young sisters in a bed under the roof of their childhood home. Wind on the window. How could anything less deserve to be destroyed? I thought we would be awake all night. Awake for the rest of our lives. The spaces between our words grew. It became difficult to tell when we were talking and when we were silent. The hairs of our arms touched. It was late, and we were tired. We assumed there would be other nights. Anna's breathing started to slow, but I still wanted to talk. She rolled onto her side. I said, "I want to tell you something." She said, "You can tell me tomorrow." I had never told her how much I loved her. She was my sister. We slept in the same bed. There was never a right time to say it. It was always unnecessary. The books in my father's shed were sighing. The sheets were rising and falling around me with Anna's breathing. I thought about waking her, but it was unnecessary. There would be other nights. And how can you say I love you to someone you love? I rolled onto my side and fell asleep next to her. Here is the point of everything I have been trying to tell you, Oscar. It's always necessary. I love you. Grandma.
Beautiful and true. Mom made spaghetti for dinner that night. Ron ate with us. I asked him if he was still interested in buying me a 5-piece drum set with Zildjian cymbals. He said, "Yeah, I think that'd be great." "How about a double bass pedal?" "I don't know what that is, but I bet we could arrange it." I asked him why he didn't have his own family. Mom said, "Oscar." I said, "What?" Ron put down his knife and fork and said, "It's okay." He said, "I did have a family, Oscar. I had a wife and a daughter." "Did you get divorced?" He laughed and said, "No." "Then where are they?" Mom looked at her plate. Ron said, "They were in an accident." "What kind of accident?" "A car accident." "I didn't know that." "Your mom and I met in a group for people that have lost family. That's where we became friends." I didn't look at Mom, and she didn't look at me. Why hadn't she told me she was in a group? "How come you didn't die in the accident?" Mom said, "That's enough, Oscar." Ron said, "I wasn't in the car." "Why weren't you in the car?" Mom looked out the window. Ron ran his finger around his plate and said, "I don't know." "What's weird," I said, "is that I've never seen you cry." He said, "I cry all the time." My backpack was already packed, and I'd already gotten the other supplies together, like the altimeter and the granola bars and the Swiss Army knife I'd dug up in Central Park, so there was nothing else to do. Mom tucked me in at 9:36. "Do you want me to read to you?" "No, thanks." "Is there anything you want to talk about?" If she wasn't going to say anything, I wasn't going to say anything, so I shook my head no. "I could make up a story." "No, thank you." "Or look for mistakes in the Times?" "Thanks, Mom, but not really."
That was nice of Ron, to tell you about his family.
I guess so.
Try to be nice to him. He's been such a good friend. And he needs help, too.
I'm tired.
I set my alarm for 11:50 p.m., even though I knew I wouldn't sleep. While I lay there in bed, waiting for the time to come, I did a lot of inventing. I invented a biodegradable car. I invented a book that listed every word in every language. It wouldn't be a very useful book, but you could hold it and know that everything you could possibly say was in your hands. What about a Googleplex telephones? What about safety nets everywhere? At 11:50 p.m., I got out of bed extremely quietly, took my things from under the bed, and opened the door 1 millimeter at a time so it wouldn't make any noise. Bart, the night doorman, was asleep at the desk, which was lucky because it meant I didn't have to tell any more lies. The renter was waiting for me under the street lamp. We shook hands, which was weird. At exactly 12 o'clock, Gerald pulled up in the limousine. He opened the door for us, and I told him, "I knew you'd be on time." He patted me on the back and said, "I wouldn't be late." It was my second time in a limousine ever. As we drove, I imagined we were standing still and the world was coming toward us. The renter sat all the way on his side, not doing anything, and I saw the Trump Tower, which Dad thought was the ugliest building in America, and the United Nations, which Dad thought was incredibly beautiful. I rolled down the window and stuck my arm out. I curved my hand like an airplane wing. If my hand had been big enough, I could have made the limousine fly. What about enormous gloves? Gerald smiled at me in the rearview mirror and asked if we wanted any music. I asked him if he had any kids. He said he had 2 daughters. What do they like?
What do they like?
Yeah. Let me see. Kelly, my baby, likes Barbie and puppies and bead bracelets.
I'll make her a bead bracelet.
I'm sure she'd like that.
What else?
If it's soft and pink, she likes it.
I like soft and pink things, too.
He said, "Well, all right.
What about your other daughter?"
"Janet, she likes sports. Her favorite is basketball, and I'll tell you, she can play. I don't mean for a girl, either. I mean she's good."
"Are they both special?"
He cracked up and said, "Of course their pop is going to say they're special.
But objectively..."
"What's that?"
"Like, factually, truthfully."
"The truth is that I'm their pop."
I stared out the window some more.
We went over the part of the bridge that wasn't in any borough, and I turned around and watched the buildings get smaller. I figured out which button opened the sunroof, and I stood up with the top half of my body sticking out of the car. I took pictures of the stars with Grandpa's camera, and in my head, I connected them to make words, whatever words I wanted. Whenever we were about to go under a bridge or into a tunnel, Gerald told me to get back into the car so I wouldn't be decapitated, which I know about, but really, really wish I didn't. In my brain, I made shoe and inertia and invincible. It was 12:56 a.m. when Gerald drove up onto the grass and pulled the limousine right next to the cemetery. I put on my backpack, and the renter got the shovel, and we climbed onto the roof of the limousine so we could get over the fence. Gerald whispered,
"You sure you want to do this?"
Through the fence, I told him, "It probably won't take more than 20 minutes, maybe 30. He tossed over the renter's suitcases and said,
"I'll be here."
Because it was so dark, we had to follow the beam of my flashlight. I pointed it at a lot of tombstones, looking for Dad's. Mark Crawford, Diana Straight, Jason Barker Jr.,
Morris Cooper, May Goodman, Helen Stein, Gregory Robertson Judd, John Fielder, Susan Kidd. I kept thinking about how they were all the names of dead people, and how names are basically the only thing that dead people keep. It was 1:22 when we found Dad's grave. The renter handed me the shovel. I said, "You go first." He put it in my hand. I pushed it into the dirt and stepped all of my weight on it. I didn't even know how many pounds I was because I'd been so busy trying to find Dad. It was extremely hard work, and I was only strong enough to remove a little bit of dirt at a time. My arms got incredibly tired, but that was okay because since we only had one shovel, we took turns. The 20 minutes passed, and then another 20 minutes. We kept digging, but we weren't getting anywhere. Another 20 minutes passed. Then, the batteries in the flashlight ran out, and we couldn't see our hands in front of us. That wasn't part of our plan, and neither were replacement batteries, even though they obviously should have been. How could I have forgotten something so simple and important? I called Gerald's cell phone and asked if he could go pick up some D batteries for us. He said, "Everything all right?" It was so dark that it was even hard to hear. I said, "Yeah, we're okay. We just need some D batteries." He said the only store he remembered was about 15 minutes away. I told him, "I'll pay you extra." He said, "It's not about paying me extra." Fortunately, because what we were doing was digging up Dad's grave, we didn't need to see our hands in front of us. We only had to feel the shovel moving the dirt. So we shoveled in the darkness and silence. I thought about everything underground, like worms and roots and clay and buried treasure. We shoveled. I wondered how many things had died since the first thing was born. A trillion? A Googleplex? We shoveled. I wondered what the renter was thinking about. After a while, my phone played The Flight of the Bumblebee, so I looked at the caller ID. Gerald. "Got him. Can you bring him to us so we don't have to waste time going back to the limousine?" He didn't say anything for a few seconds. "I guess I could do that." I couldn't describe where we were to him, so I just kept calling his name, and he found my voice. It felt much better to be able to see. Gerald said, "Doesn't look like you two have gotten very far." I told him, "We're not good shovelers." He put his driving gloves in his jacket pocket, kissed the cross that he wore around his neck, and took the shovel from me. Because he was so strong, he could move a lot of dirt quickly. It was 2:56 when the shovel touched the coffin. We all heard the sound and looked at each other. I told Gerald thanks. He winked at me, then started walking back to the car, and then he disappeared in the darkness. "Oh, yeah," I heard him say, even though I couldn't find him with my flashlight. "Janet, the older one, she loves cereal. She'd eat it 3 meals a day if we let her." I told him, "I love cereal, too." He said, "All right." And his footsteps got quieter and quieter. I lowered myself into the hole and used my paintbrush to wipe away the dirt that was left. One thing that surprised me was that the coffin was wet. I guess I wasn't expecting that, because how could so much water get underground? Another thing that surprised me was that the coffin was cracked in a few places, probably from the weight of all that dirt. If Dad had been in there, ants and worms could have gotten in through the cracks and eaten him, or at least microscopic bacteria could have. I knew it shouldn't matter, because once you're dead, you don't feel anything. So why did it feel like it mattered? Another thing that surprised me was how the coffin wasn't locked or even nailed shut. The lid just rested on top of it so that anyone who wanted to could open it up. That didn't seem right. But on the other hand,
Who'd want to open a coffin? I opened the coffin. I was surprised again, although again I shouldn't have been. I was surprised that Dad wasn't there. In my brain, I knew he wouldn't be, obviously, but I guess my heart believed something else. Or maybe I was surprised by how incredibly empty it was. I felt like I was looking into the dictionary definition of emptiness. I'd had the idea to dig up Dad's coffin the night after I met the renter. I was lying in bed, and I had the revelation, like a simple solution to an impossible problem. The next morning, I threw pebbles at the guest room window, like he wrote for me to do in his note, but I'm not very accurate at throwing, so I had Walt do it. When the renter met me at the corner, I told him my idea. He wrote, "Why would you want to do that?" I told him, "Because it's the truth, and Dad loved the truth." "What truth?" "That he's dead." After that, we met every afternoon and discussed the details like we were planning a war. We talked about how we'd get to the cemetery and different ways of climbing fences and where we'd find a shovel and all of the other necessary instruments like a flashlight and wire cutters and juice boxes. We planned and planned, but for some reason, we never talked about what we'd actually do once we'd opened the coffin. It wasn't until the day before we were going to go that the renter asked the obvious question. I told him, "We'll fill it, obviously." He asked another obvious question. At first I suggested filling the coffin with things from Dad's life, like his red pens, or his jeweler's magnifying glass, which is called a loop, or even his tuxedo. I guess I got that idea from the blacks who made museums of each other. But the more we discussed it, the less sense it made, because what good would that do anyway? Dad wouldn't be able to use them because he was dead, and the renter also pointed out that it would probably be nice to have things of his around. I could fill his coffin with jewelry like they used to do with famous Egyptians, which I know about. But he wasn't Egyptian. And he didn't like jewelry. He didn't like jewelry? Maybe I could bury things I'm ashamed of, I suggested, and in my head I was thinking of the old telephone and the sheet of stamps of great American inventors that I got mad at Grandma about and the script of Hamlet and the letters I'd received from strangers and the stupid card I'd made for myself and my tambourine and the unfinished scarf. But that didn't make any sense either, because the renter reminded me that just because you bury something, you don't really bury it. "Then what?" I asked. "I have an idea," he wrote. "I'll show you tomorrow." Why did I trust him so much? The next night, when I met him on the corner at 11:50, he had two suitcases. I didn't ask him what was in them because, for some reason, I thought I should wait until he told me, even though he was my dad, which made the coffin mine, too. 3 hours later, when I climbed into the hole, brushed away the dirt, and opened the lid, the renter opened the suitcases. They were filled with papers. I asked him what they were. He wrote, "I lost a son."
"You did?"
He showed me his left palm.
"How did he die?"
"I lost him before he died."
"How?"
"I went away."
"Why?"
He wrote, "I was afraid."
"Afraid of what?"
"Afraid of losing him."
"Were you afraid of him dying?"
"I was afraid of him living."
"Why?"
He wrote, "Life is scarier than death."
"So what's all that paper?"
He wrote, "Things I wasn't able to tell him. Letters."
To be honest, I don't know what I understood then. I don't think I figured out that he was my grandpa, not even in the deep parts of my brain. I definitely didn't make the connection between the letters in his suitcases and the envelopes in Grandma's dresser, even if I should have.
but I must have understood something. I must have. Because why else would I have opened my left hand? When I got home, it was 4:22 a.m. Mom was on the sofa by the door. I thought she'd be incredibly angry at me, but she didn't say anything. She just kissed my head. "Don't you want to know where I was?" she said. "I trust you." "But aren't you curious?" she said. "I assume you'd tell me if you wanted me to know." "Are you going to tuck me in?" "I thought I'd stay here for a little while longer." "Are you mad at me?" She shook her head, "No." "Is Ron mad at me?" "No." "Are you sure?" "Yes." I went to my room. My hands were dirty, but I didn't wash them. I wanted them to stay dirty, at least until the next morning. I hoped some of the dirt would stay under my fingernails for a long time, and maybe some of the microscopic material would be there forever. I turned off the lights. I put my backpack on the floor, took off my clothes, and got into bed. I stared at the fake stars. What about windmills on the roof of every skyscraper? What about a kite string bracelet? A fishing line bracelet? What if skyscrapers had roots? What if you had to water skyscrapers and play classical music to them and know if they like sun or shade? What about a tea kettle? I got out of bed and ran to the door in my undies. Mom was still on the sofa. She wasn't reading or listening to music or doing anything. She said, "You're awake." I started crying. She opened her arms and said, "What is it?" I ran to her and said, "I don't want to be hospitalized." She pulled me into her so my head was against the soft part of her shoulder, and she squeezed me. "You're not going to be hospitalized." I told her, "I promise I'm going to be better soon." She said, "There's nothing wrong with you." "I'll be happy and normal." She put her fingers around the back of my neck. I told her, "I tried incredibly hard. I don't know how I could have tried harder." She said, "Dad would have been very proud of you." "Do you think so?"
"I know so."
I cried some more. I wanted to tell her all of the lies that I'd told her. And then I wanted her to tell me that it was okay, because sometimes you have to do something bad to do something good. And then I wanted to tell her about the phone. And then I wanted her to tell me that Dad still would have been proud of me. She said, "Dad called me from the building that day." I pulled away from her. "What?" "He called from the building."
"You mean on your cell phone?"
She nodded yes, and it was the first time I'd ever seen her not try to stop her tears. Was she relieved? Was she depressed? Grateful? Exhausted?
"What did he say?"
"He told me he was on the street and that he'd gotten out of the building. He said he was walking home."
"But he wasn't."
"No." Was I angry? Was I glad?
"He made it up so you wouldn't worry."
"That's right." Frustrated? Anxious? Optimistic?
"But he knew you knew."
"He did." I put my fingers around her neck where her hair started. I don't know how late it got. I probably fell asleep, but I don't remember. I cried so much that everything blurred into everything else. At some point, she was carrying me to my room. Then I was in bed. She was looking over me. I don't believe in God, but I believe that things are extremely complicated, and her looking over me was as complicated as anything ever could be. But it was also incredibly simple. In my only life, she was my mom, and I was her son. I told her, "It's okay if you fall in love again." She said, "I won't fall in love again." I told her, "I want you to." She kissed me and said, "I'll never fall in love again." I told her, "You don't have to make it up so I won't worry." She said, "I love you." I rolled onto my side and listened to her walk back to the sofa. I heard her crying. I imagined her wet sleeves, her exhausted eyes. 1:51. 4:38. 7 minutes. I felt in the space between the bed and the wall and found stuff that happened to me. It was completely full. I was going to have to start a new volume soon. I read that it was the paper that kept the towers burning. All of those notepads and Xeroxes and printed emails and photographs of kids and books and dollar bills in wallets and documents in files, all of them were fuel. Maybe if we lived in a paperless society, which lots of scientists say we'll probably live in one day soon, Dad would still be alive. Maybe I shouldn't start a new volume. I grabbed the flashlight from my backpack and aimed it at the book. I saw maps and drawings, pictures from magazines and newspapers and the internet, pictures I'd taken with Grandpa's camera. The whole world was in there. Finally, I found the falling body. Was it Dad? Maybe. Whoever it was somebody. I ripped the pages out of the book. I reversed the order, so the last one was first, and the first was last. When I flipped through them, it looked like the man was floating up through the sky. And if I'd had more pictures, he would have flown through a window, back into the building, and the smoke would have poured into the hole that the plane was about to come out of. Dad would have left his messages backward until the machine was empty, and the plane would have flown backward away from him, all the way to Boston. He would have taken the elevator to the street and pressed the button for the top floor. He would have walked backward to the subway, and the subway would have gone backward through the tunnel, back to our stop. Dad would have gone backward through the turnstile, then swiped his Metro card backward, then walked home backward as he read the New York Times from right to left. He would have spit coffee into his mug, unbrushed his teeth, and put hair on his face with a razor. He would have gotten back into bed. The alarm would have rung backward. He would have dreamt backward. Then, he would have gotten up again at the end of the night before the worst day. He would have walked backward to my room, whistling "I Am the Walrus" backward. He would have gotten into bed with me. We would have looked at the stars on my ceiling,
which would have pulled back their light from our eyes. I'd have said nothing, backward. He'd have said,
"Yeah, buddy?"
Backward. I'd have said, "Dad?" Backward, which would have sounded the same as "Dad" forward. He would have told me the story of the sixth burrow, from the voice in the can at the end to the beginning, from "I love you" to "once upon a time." We would have been safe.
The End. You've been listening to Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close by Jonathan Safran Foer. Narrated by Barbara Caruso, Richard Ferrone, and Jeff Woodman. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.